afternoon. The lecture is going to be exactly on time because of a simple reason. I have a 6:57 train to Frankfurt Airport. So I'm not going to drag you too much, and then we have to drink some wine and maybe some questions. So anyway, I'm going to tell you a story. Actually, it's a marathon that we started it, but many joined us around the US, and now it became probably one of the richest platforms for biomedical research that we couldn't have imagined when we started it, when we started to work on protein degradation. When I was a graduate student with Avram Hershko, and at that time, people really didn't care about protein degradation. These were the times that everybody was fascinated about the central dogma of biology. Watson, Crick were dominating the field. Everybody was fascinated about how the genetic code is decoded from the genome to the transcriptome to the proteome. And then you have proteins and let's send them to hell. And whenever they are ending up their lives, and really nobody, there were very, very few people in the field. But nevertheless, there were very interesting points there, or some findings that some strange people that were nevertheless in the field found that attracted our attention. And we decided to go after it. And it was really a rewarding trip. So this is the basically for me biology. I mean, biology is encapsulated in this slide. When we take amino acids and we are extracting one molecule of water, that's by the way everything I know about chemistry. I wasn't trained in chemistry, I had no idea about chemistry. I'm a trained surgeon, so I know nothing about my best education was in the medical school. The medical school is like the Spanish dinner, it's tapas. You have small tasting dishes, I mean nothing really main course. I mean. So here is how we synthesize proteins. We extract a molecule of water from two adjacent amino acids and we combine them. Obviously we need to put the two amino acids in the right place, and that's coded by the genetic code. So the whole synthetic machinery is behind, and we are interested in the opposite. The chemistry is the same. So the chemistry is introduction of a molecule of water into the peptide bond and cleaving it off. And that has been known for years. Peptic enzymes, proteolytic enzymes have been known for years. Trypsin, chymotrypsin, and digestive enzyme in the gastrointestinal tract. The chemistry has been known for years. But obviously these two arrows do represent completely two different biological, cumbersome, awfully complicated and regulated process, though the chemistry appears simple. So proteolysis in the body occurs in many places, and it's kind of, as we climb up the ladder, it becomes more and more complex, more and more specific, more and more selective. Gastrointestinal tract, very simple. Every food that we put in is degraded, let it be meat, cheese, eggs, whatever we put, and it's a non-discriminatory process. We degrade proteins because we need to remove antigenicity, we cannot challenge the immune system with foreign proteins, and obviously we derive also energy from proteins, like we derive them from fats and from carbohydrates. Once we, but the gastrointestinal tract is topologically extracorporeal. It's a tube that crosses the body. For us, it's outside the body. Then we move into the body, but we are still outside the cell, and here we need to exercise control already. We cannot have just floating, free-floating proteolytic enzymes like we float in the small intestine, because then it will become chaotic. And there are proteolytic system, controlled proteolytic system, numerous of them in the circulation, extracellular. One of them is the blood coagulation system, that is a cascade of proteases that activate one another, and at the end, fibrinogen is converted to fibrin, and you can open a textbook of medicine and you will find numerous diseases that are attributed to aberrations in blood coagulation, from hypercoagulability, for example, heart attack, as is known in the clinical jargon as myocardial infarction, and hypocoagulability, like the whole set of genetic diseases, hemophilias, where people can get wounded, scratched, and really bleed profusely without control. So this is a bona fide proteolytic system. We were not interested even here, we were interested in how the cell degrades its own proteins. And at the time that we approached it, it was already known that the process is extensive. We are degrading about 8%, 6 to 8%, depending on the physiological state of our cellular proteins. which if you think about it, it's a huge number. This is an hour daily. Daily we are removing 6 to 8% of our proteins, and we are resynthesizing new ones to replace them. Some of them are extremely stable, hemoglobin, and others are living forever, actin, myosin. But some proteins turn over numerous times an hour. They call it transcription factor, p53, MYC, JUN, FOS, IKAPA-B. I mean, there are many proteins that are extremely short-lived, but the average is 6 to 8% a day, which immediately raises several interesting questions. One question is why we do it at all. I mean, then the next question is who carries it out? Then the next question is what happens if the one that carries it out goes wrong? Or something happens, and then if it goes wrong, which again in clinical language it means disease, then can we do something about it? So once you have a process, you ask yourself all these kind of questions, and there is an even preceding, in my opinion, much more interesting question. If in 20 days or whatever, doesn't matter, my whole proteome was completely exchanged with a new one, then who am I anyway? Now, think about it. It's a funny question, but if you think about our world that surrounds us, think about a computer. I can take this computer and buy a completely new one which is identical, but the software must be transferred from one computer to another. In the body, while I'm changing the hardware, the software still keeps going on and even improves. Because today I'm in Freiburg, so I have no friends and no memories. So I'm even adding to my software. But nevertheless, I'm exchanging my hardware. So how is it that despite of the change of the hardware, which is extremely expensive, decades-old software that goes back to my childhood is still being carried along the way? This is not a simple biological question. It is a biological question. Not a simple one. It has to do with imprinting. But it deserves an advanced course and discussion of its own. But we won't talk about it, and we'll talk about why it happens, who carries it out, what happens if it goes wrong, and whether we can do something about it. And with time limit, we'll devote 8 minutes, grosso modo, to each of these major questions. Huge injustice to a field that now encompasses more than 150,000 papers. And so why we do it? We do it because first and foremost, and this is really new for us, this is discovery of basically the last 10 years, quality control. We now have a whole set of diseases that are quality control diseases, and we know that proteins are complex structures, and they get denatured, misfolded. Many proteins are synthesized in substoichiometric or suprastoichiometric quantities compared to other subunits in complexes. All these proteins must be removed. Think about 37 degrees. This is the most uncorn temperature which you can put proteins. The most common instrument device in my lab is either an ice bucket, ice crushers, nitrogen durers, and Revcos. We have 7 Revcos in the lab. Proteins don't like to be at high temperature. We put them there only to carry out reactions, and then we put them back. 37 degrees is a very bad temperature, but probably this is the temperature that was selected by evolution for mammals in order to carry out most efficiently the catalysis of the numerous processes that in the efficient manner enough to make us what we are. But again, forget about temperature. Oxygen, 21% oxygen. Proteins hate it, but nevertheless, we need it in order to carry out efficiently the energy and the energy metabolism to produce enough ADP in the cyclic acid cycle in order to survive. So we can think about it a lot, but proteins get denatured and misfolded, and once they are misfolded and denatured, they have to be removed because they are harmful. And a whole set of diseases, again, without going into details, neurodegenerative diseases are all belonging now to the newly emerging concept of quality control diseases. And there are many more. There are lung diseases, cystic fibrosis is a per se, bona fide quality control diseases. There are an abnormal protein, a mutated protein, not an abnormal protein, the cystic fibrosis trans membrane conductance regulator, or the CF protein, is the mutated CF protein is degraded by the ubiquitin system, because the ubiquitin system identifies this as a mutated protein, but it's a normal protein. If you take the mutated Delta F508, the most common and mutated cystic fibrosis protein, and you put it into a liposome, it will pump chloride for you like hell. It's a normal protein. But we remove it mistakenly because the system identifies it as a mutated protein, and rightly so. The system did the right job, but this is a normal protein, and here the disease can show. And many other diseases, liver diseases and so on. Then, so we remove proteins because of quality control, we remove proteins because we don't need them anymore, they are normal, cell cycle regulators, transcription factor, we just don't need them anymore. So we remove them. They are healthy. Again, you can argue against God, why did he pick up such an expensive way to regulate processes, why not to sequester proteins? Why not to phosphorylate them, dephosphorylate them, glycosylate them, whatever? Why to remove it? It's very expensive to remove a protein. To take a protein and to cut every amino acid away, and in each peptide bond we put two ATPs, and then to resynthesize it, and then to put another two ATPs back. And it's a very expensive way. But again, we are not arguing with God. We try to think evolution. And when we look at the ubiquitin system, we realize that for very critically important processes like cell cycle regulation, we prefer to remove a protein because once we cut a protein, we can't glue it back. There is no way to glue it back. It's completely irreversible. And rather than phosphorylate and dephosphorylate it, which is amenable a little bit more to mistakes, and the cell may regret or something will happen, and you can imagine during cell division, during the S phase, when the cell is stuck with 1.35 doses of DNA, it decides, no, I don't want to divide anymore. I want to go back. Then what does it do with, what does it do with all the excess? Yeah, but again, you can think about it as a kind of a safety, of an evolutionarily safety one. And then obviously in order to maintain the morphogenetic and differentiated state of tissues, we remove proteins permanently. But then they come back during malignant transformation. So that's, even then we cannot shut it down completely. Just a little bit about the history, the system, not the system, the ubiquitin system, the phenomenon of protein dynamics was discovered by Rudolf Zellner, who actually was here in Freiburg, worked in this university, a Jewish scientist that left Germany upon the rise of the Nazis to power. Just came to me now and I'm lecturing that he was here in Freiburg. And he went to the United States along with many Jews that at that time were fired from their institutes, and Albert Einstein left Germany and many more. You all know about it. It was a big disaster to German science at that time. And they gave America a huge gift. And this is the term Hitler's gift became really a term in the vocabulary of science, and many, and they gave a huge gift of mature, excellent scientists that came on a silver platter to the United States. Another one that used it in this case is Eugene Kennedy at Harvard in a review in JDC. And you can see here Fritz Lippmann, who got the Nobel Prize for discovering coenzyme A. He deserved it for many other ones. And Rudolf Schenheimer, the one that I mentioned, and I'll keep on telling you about him, from our blog, the guy who discovered the scientist who discovered the biosynthetic pathway of cholesterol. And Rudolf Schenheimer did simple experiments. He just fed N15 labeled amino acids to rats and found that the amino acid goes into the rat protein and then comes out. So it labels the protein. It was a simple in vivo pulse chase experiment. But it was then a mass spectrometer because it was a heavy isotope. And he concluded that proteins are dynamic. People, so we can raise our eyebrows and say, so what's the big deal about it? Well, at that time people thought that proteins are static. This was a new discovery in the late 30s and early 40s. And he committed suicide. It's very interesting. It was kind of a love affair. I will not go into it. It's very interesting. I found this obituary. Part of it is in German, actually, in the public library in New York, in the New York Times in August of 41. And it says that his work helped establish that the living body is a chemical laboratory environment of complex transformations of matter are taking place incessantly. So the body is dynamic. He published this book, it's not him, it's came in 42. His successor published a small book, all his lectures were in the book. And he concluded in the book that the body is dynamic. With all the macromolecules, he studied also lipids and carbohydrates, and he found that it's all dynamics. People didn't accept it. We are moving quickly to the mid-50s. People didn't accept it, and not just people, but excellent scientists like David Hoggers, the founding father of modern flight genetics, Jacques Monod, and they claimed that Schirmheimer was completely wrong. Forget about him. And they cited him, and they challenged him directly, and I just show you one statement, and they say, our experiments have shown the proteins of E. coli in that case are static. Or they say, there seems to be at present no evidence that protein molecules within cells of mammalian tissues are in a dynamic state. So they use the term, the dynamic state that Schirmheimer used. When you read the discussion, they completely tear it into tiny small pieces. They said he was wrong. Proteins are stable, and this is the mid-50s. So at that time, as you probably don't remember, because 99% of you were not there at the time, I was still in kindergarten at the time, and when people tell you that proteins are, when Jacques Monod tells you that proteins don't degrade, you better believe in it and go to study something else. And people indeed did study protein degradation. But then things started to shatter a little. So Mel Simpson in Yale in the mid-50s found that protein degradation paradoxically is ATP dependent. It requires metabolic energy, which didn't make any sense, because if we eat a steak or cheese and we put it into our gastrointestinal tract, we derive energy. Proteins are rich in energy, so why to invest energy in order to degrade a high energy macromolecule into low energy ingredients, which are amino acids? But nevertheless, this is protein degradation. Normally, once you change the oxygen to nitrogen, protein degradation ceases altogether. So he concluded that it's ATP dependent. He couldn't foresee why or understand why, but this was published and left alone in the literature until we came in about 80, almost 30 years later to redeem this finding from its exile. Then came Christian Dedin that won the Nobel Prize for discovering the lysosome, and everything was solved. Almost everything. He said, the lysosome degrades all proteins in the body. It degrades extracellular proteins, the cell pinocytose, endocytose, receptor-mediated endocytose, phagocytose, everything goes into vesicles in the cell surface. The vesicles move endosomes into the lysosome, they fuse, they pour their contents, and the lysosome is rich in proteases, they chew them. How about intracellular proteins also? Autophagy. Everybody talks today on autophagy. There is macroautophagy that is stress-induced, and there is microautophagy. So let's talk about microautophagy. This lysosome pinches off droplets of the cytosol, converts them into vacuoles, pour the contents into the lysosome, and everything is degraded. So we have microautophagy, macroautophagy, and the lysosome degrades cellular proteins, whether they come from the outside or they come from the inside. Why ATP? Clear. The intralysosomal pH is low, it's about 5.5. The cytosolic pH is 7.5. We need to maintain two log gradients of hydrogen ions across the membrane. We need to pump ions in hydrogen ions in order to keep the intralysosomal pH acidic, because this is optimal for the activity of the lysosomal proteases, and here we need ATP. So we have an organelle, proteins are degraded, we have an explanation for ATP, and this comes to the world. Now, people became restless again, but it took them another 20 years to become restless. And people found that, well, this is just compilation of data from the literature, from a review that was written by Fred Goldberg at Harvard, that proteins have different half-life times, from several minutes to hours. This could be reconciled with the lysosomal theory, because all the proteins of the cytosol are contained in these droplets, so they are presented. Once they are in the lysosome, nobody can rescue itself from the collection, from the group of risk of dangerous sharks that are flying in, so swimming in the lysosome. I mean, all the cathepsins A and B and C and D and E, and they have different specificities. Within minutes, they will take away everything. You cannot really survive this hostile environment. So how is it that some proteins can survive for minutes and some can survive for hours? Not only that, but then people discovered that some proteins change their half-life time along under different physiological conditions. Cyclades, for example, that's their name. Tim Hunt, Hartwell-Leland, Paul Nerth, the wonderful discovery of the cyclades and the cell cycle regulation. Mitotic cyclades are stable all along the cell cycle. They accumulate, and within, once the cell enters mitosis, bang, 5 minutes, they are degraded. How is it? I mean, how do in 5 minutes all of a sudden, and how they can they organize themselves in one microautophagic vacuole that spares all the other proteins, go to the lysosome, degrade in 5 minutes? This was out of the question. Actually, even Tim Hunt, in his 1982 papers, when he discovered cyclins and he predicted that there would be a cyclin degradase, he called it in the paper, he already extruded the lysosome because he said that the kinetics and the specificity don't fit in, but he didn't know anything of what's going on. And then came the wonderful experimentalist, Brian Pooley, did a simple experiment, and he found what he did, he dissipated the intralysosomal pH by adding chloroquine. Chloroquine is a base, it's like sodium hydroxide. It's protonated, the lysosome pH goes up and it's shut down. You don't need siRNA, you don't need hsRNA, you don't need genetic manipulation, you just add a base, ammonium chloride to the cells, and the lysosome shut down. And what he found is the following, that when you shut down the lysosome, you almost don't change the degradation of intracellular proteins. It goes down from 2.4 to 2.3 in one experiment, from 4 to 3.3, but the degradation of extracellular proteins, those that come from the outside, is going down dramatically. So he concluded that in the cell, there must be two systems. The lysosome, that will degrade extracellular proteins, because their degradation is inhibitable by shutting down the lysosome, and then another system that will involve, that will take care of the degradation of intracellular proteins. And he concluded it in a very poetic way. And what he wrote is the following, without going into the experimental details, which are really fantastic. He said the exogenous proteins will be broken down in the lysosome. Why? Because we can inhibit them by chloroquine, while the endogenous proteins will be broken down wherever it is that endogenous proteins are broken down. Somewhere. That's his word, verbatim. But this was the first realization that there must be two systems. I came to know Brian. Brian died in the early 80s, tragically, and I visited his lab. I was a young graduate student with Avraham Hershko, and he started to look for the system, and in parallel, we started to look for the system. Fred Goldberg at Harvard started to look for the system. There were very few people that were really interested, but cutting the history short, we went to reticulocytes. Reticulocytes are terminally differentiated red blood cells. They don't have lysosomes already, so there is no background. They already expelled the lysosome on their way to maturation, but they nevertheless still involved heavily in the degradation of all their machineries, because at the end they are ending up as a red blood cell, and a red blood cell is a very primitive cell. It has nothing, basically. It has a glycolytic machinery, glutathione-generating machinery, very developed cytoskeleton, so they can swim for 120 days during the capillaries, and obviously hemoglobin, the oxygen-carrying protein. And we published the first paper in 78 in BBRC. I don't want to give you a long lecture on this paper, on what is derived from this paper. But first of all, you all know it's a very low-impact factor paper that nowadays will carry you nowhere. Second, this paper was sufficient to go to Sweden. We didn't need more than this paper to go to Sweden. So it tells you that it doesn't matter where you publish, but it matters what you publish. So this was one lesson. And then another lesson, which I'll show you very quickly, is how we enslaved ourselves today to what I call numerical bibliometrics. Again, I will not delve into it. I'm just trying to jump very quickly, because when people talk to you, the only thing that you want to do, or not to you, but to promotion committees, is how many Nature papers they have, how many Cell papers they have, and how many times they are cited, and if you can save three questions and you can have them evaluated by one number, that these days is called the H factor, whatever factor, then it's better. Don't ask them even about nature or anything. Tell me what your H factor and I'll tell you who you are. And whether you will become a professor in my institute or not. So I'll show you how you can miss it easily. I started my PhD, and a week later, my mentor went to a sabbatical. He didn't know my name, he could hardly remember me. He went away. I did this work by myself, sent him the data, and he said to me, instead of sending it back, because it was mail, no Federal Express, let me send it directly to the journal without you even proofing it. Since he didn't know my name, to spell it, he put two mistakes in my name. My name spells with two A, so he put an H in the middle, which is fine. Because the Hebrew spells like that. But doesn't matter, in English it's wrong. But in the PubMed, you don't care about your first name, you care about your last name. But then, he missed a C here. Up between the E and the H, there should be a C, Chicano. So this paper disappeared from the PubMed. You will not find it in the PubMed under my name. If you look for this author, you will find that this author published one single paper. But if you look for my name, you will not find this work. So, learn yourself the lesson. Anyway, what we did here is the following. We had all the system already here, in this single paper. We took a high-speed supernatant from the cells, no lysosome, neutral pH, so it cannot be even lysosome, and we got an ATP-dependent degradation of a model substrate. Doesn't matter, you see, 1.5 without ATP, plus ATP 10. Then, like biochemists, you want to purify the ATP-dependent protease. We had in mind one protease, because everybody knows that protease degrade proteins. Trypsin degrades proteins. Chymotrypsin degrades proteins. So we started to look for the proteins, and already at the first stage we lost. We just took the lysate and we cut it artificially by a method. Doesn't matter. In this case, it's a anion exchange cone. Doesn't matter. So we cut it into two halves. Let's say the breakthrough material and the absorbed high salt diluted material. The first half didn't have any activity. The second half didn't have any activity. But we had to combine the two in order to get the activity. Now, what was the... We were already at that stage. In the first experiment, we were out of paradigm. Because the paradigm in the protolytic field calls for a tango of two, a protease and a substrate. Here we had three. One and two enzymes and a substrate. Now, don't forget, this is a crude extract. We cut it artificially into two. Who told us that fraction one has only one component? Maybe it has two. Maybe it has 20, maybe it has 200, maybe it has 2,000, I don't know. It's an artificial cut. And then the same for fraction 2. So what we did, because we are, I believe, good biochemists, we did exactly the same experiment, but in an analogy to the experiment that was done by Erwin Enger and Bernd Sackmann here in Germany when they patch-clamped the cells. You clamp the voltage in order to monitor action potential. So what we did, we clamped one fraction. We take it and we fix it. We said, we are going to this one, and then we took only fraction two and we put it on a column. Then we lost the activity again, against fraction one. So we went to the column and we complemented, then we found two. Then the two, we called them 2A and 2B. Doesn't matter, I'm just trying to show you how we progress. We found 2A and 2B. So we took fraction one and 2A and we fixed them, we clamped it. We took 2B, we put it on another column. 2B now became 2B prime and 2B 2 prime. We took 2B 2 prime, fixed it, along with the other. And so we progressed. Until we had the system in principle. We didn't have it in whole. We had all the functions that we needed. The whole story was discovered only 10 years ago when the human genome was discovered. And now we know that the ubiquitin system has about 2,000 components. It's about 10% of the human genome, or a little bit less, and it's a very cumbersome system, and I will not go to the chemistry, I will just give you some principles of the system. But we really didn't realize that the size and the magnitude, though we had hints before from his genetics, from elegance genetics, that the system is much broader than our initial system, but now we know the finite number. We know exactly the structure, the motifs, the domains, the families. We have a huge idea about the system, and the system acts like that. And I show you again just the principles, because there is much into the principles and why nature evolved such a cumbersome system. This is the basic system. It's a two-step system. There are three enzymes, initially E1, E2, and E3. And here comes the substrate. This is the substrate to be degraded. The substrate is being bound to an enzyme called E3, or ubiquitin ligase. This is an enzyme that binds ubiquitin. You will, in a minute, I'll tell you what it is. Many of you probably know. And there are about 1,000 ubiquitin ligases in the database. So half of the ubiquitin system are just this group of enzymes. And they divided into subfamilies. They are ring finger and hectomain that were discovered by a German scientist, by Martin Scheffner and Constance. So there is the hectomain and PhD domain and U-box. And we now know how they did, but there are thousands of them. And they recognize specifically the substrates to be degraded. And each of them will recognize only a tiny subset of the substrate, and here already we understand the specificity. So here comes already the specificity. In parallel, there is a single E1 in the database. It will take a small ubiquitin of 76 amino acids, activate it to high energy, and here we need ATP, so we knew already why we need ATP, and with the secret of the molecular details, I will not take you through that. It transfers ubiquitin in a chain reaction to another enzyme called E2. There are about 50 E2 in the database. And E2 will put the substrate with the ubiquitin on the substrate. But it won't put it once, it will put it several times. One ubiquitin bounds to the substrate, I'll show you in a minute the chemistry, the second to the first, the third to the second, the fourth to the third, and so on and so forth, to build a polyubiquitin chain. The polyubiquitin chain is the degradation signal in trans to a protease called the 26S proteasome complex that will not recognize non-ubiquitinated proteins. It will not recognize a naked protein, and this is exactly the key element, the key important element, not only of the system, but of the concept, and I'll come back to it in a minute, because this is really the only take-home message that you need to take from this lecture. The proteasome, which is a 2-megadalton, it's a huge protease. The three-dimensional structure was deciphered by Robert Huber and Wolfgang Baumeister in the Max Planck and Martin screen. And ubiquitin binds to the protease, not the substrate. And by that, the substrate will come close. The substrate will be opened by ATPases that are sitting here, will be injected into the proteolytic chamber. This is the proteolytic chamber, by the way. This weighs about 1 million dalton, each of those is 500,000, so it's a 2 million dalton protease. It's a huge cryptic protease, and I'll talk in a minute about the crypticism of it, and it will be degraded into peptides. So the system has two steps: marking of the protein for degradation by ubiquitin or polyubiquitin, and degradation of the ubiquitinated proteins by the 26S protein. Now, what's the big deal about it? The big deal about it is first the specificity. What makes a protein being ubiquitinated at a certain time? So the question, we don't care about proteolysis anymore, the shift. There was a shift in the interest, not to the protease, but to the specificity. Why a certain protein is ubiquitinated at a certain time? It can be denatured, and the ubiquitin ligase will recognize an hydrophobic patch that was otherwise buried inside the structure. It can be phosphorylated, it can be hydroxylated, it can be glycosylated, it can expose some other sequence that otherwise is buried in the structure, but here you have the specificity. Now, the beauty of the system is the cryptic protease, because proteases are wild sharks. In the proteasome, the proteases are fenced from the cell by the membrane, but they are active proteases. They are not cryptic. Here, it's a cryptic protease. It will never recognize a substrate unless it is ubiquitinated. So the protease and the substrate can live in the same compartment. Remember, the problem with the lysosome was specificity, how we cross the membrane in a specific way. Therefore, doubt started to raise about the lysosome, because the lysosome could not respond to the need, to the observed need, the experimental need for specificity. Here, the system, just the structure of the system, answer the question immediately. You have a protease that is not dangerous, it just flies around, it will not take anybody, unless this somebody is ubiquitinated. And specificity is lying, residing in the ubiquitination machinery. Yes, once you are ubiquitinated, you are doomed. But why you are ubiquitinated and how you are ubiquitinated, that endows the system with its specificity and selectivity. So the system really opened up, answered immediately, just by understanding the principle, all the open questions in the field. And then started the explosion. Once we came up with this one, the literature started to explode because everybody that worked on protein started to move into the ubiquity field. All the cell cycle people, all the transcription people, all the memory people, ERAD, ER, everybody started to move into it. So in the mid to late 1980s, we started to see really a huge growth in the system. So I just want to show you the chemistry and a little bit so you understand how the system exploded, not only because of substrate, but also because of the human genome and what happened. And then I'll go to the last part of my talk, as much time as I'm left with. I still have time? Wow, it's 6 already, so I'll take another 50 minutes. So it's ubiquitinated. The C-terminus is making an isopeptide bond with an epsilon amino group of a lysine, and then ubiquitin has 7 lysines. Lysine 48 is ubiquitinated, and then lysine 48 of the other ubiquitin is ubiquitinated, so each ubiquitin ubiquitinates the other lysine 48. But then came the story deviated completely, and Frau Melchior, when she was still in the United States, discovered a cousin, the first cousin of ubiquitin, which is called SUMO. It's not this SUMO, it's small ubiquitin modifier, and you can see here SUMO. It's a very... It's a similar protein to ubiquitin, it's a little bit longer, but it has a very similar C-terminus that attacks proteins. So proteins can be sumoylated. And then other ubiquitin-like proteins were discovered, like NAD8 and ISG15 and many others. A whole family of ubiquitin-like proteins was discovered. And each of them has its own activation system. So it has an E1 and an E2 and an E3. So the story really expanded dramatically, and each of them has its functions. So SUMO has different functions, obviously, the ubiquitin. SUMO doesn't target mostly ubiquitin for degradation. It targets ubiquitin for other, without telling you much about SUMO, for other non-protolytic functions. But the principle of modification by a ubiquitin-like protein has been maintained along evolution for numerous protolytic and non-protolytic functions. And then the story became awfully complex. And I'm just going to show you this and move for 10 minutes to medicine. So ubiquitin has 7 lysines. Each of them can be ubiquitinated. So it has lysine in position 6 and in position 11 and 27, 29, 33, 48, and 66. And as I told you, ubiquitination in 48 will go to the protocol. And then, before I finish here, I'll also define for you what is ubiquitin again. Now, so this is K48, but as I told you, we can make K6 chains and K11 chains and K27 chains and K29, and all those are linked to the substrate. And every one of them does in the substrate something else. But then there are free chains. People discover that there are free chains. They're not bound to anything. And they are involved in signaling, in the signalosome signaling, in TNF-alpha, and toll receptor-like signaling, just free chains. And then people discovered linear chains. It's head-to-tail, head-to-tail, head-to-tail. And then people discovered multiply branch chains. It's not only ubiquitin can ubiquitinate one ubiquitin in 2 sites, and maybe in 3 sites. And then it can ubiquitinate ubiquitin, not only it can ubiquitinate it in mixed ways. So this ubiquitin ubiquitinates lysine, the orange lysine. And this ubiquitinate ubiquitinate the second on the green one. And this ubiquitinate ubiquitin the other one on the blue one. So now we have an endless language. We can have multiply branched, mixed, homogeneous, free, linear, everything. We can have only monoubiquitin, monoubiquitinated. We can have oligo, we can have poly, we can have multiple mono, we can hit single. Then we can have ubiquitin like SUMO, we can hit with SUMO once. We can hit with SUMO and make poly-SUMO, and then we can have mixed chains. SUMO will prime the chain, and ubiquitin will come on top of it. So you see, again, we are not in any competition, but the field 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, opened exponentially. So first we discovered by mass spectrometry all this, and now we are after the function. So we still don't have a clue of what's going on. We're just developing antibodies which are linked specific antibodies. There are no mass spectrometric tools now, because if I want to understand the structure of this chain, I'll never be able, because in order to do mass spectrometry, we have to cleave proteins, and then we get only the linkage site, but we don't know the order of the linkages along the chain. We don't know whether we need the chain to be in certain order, whether we need to have a critical mass of some homogeneous part of the chain. We have no clue of what's going on. Not to say that we don't know the catalysis of chain formation. You can imagine that if you are putting 50 ubiquitin, each ubiquitin is 8,000, you are building a tree of 500,000 dalton, one small enzyme. So is it intermolecular, is it intramolecular? Do we go to the tip of the tree, bends, and we add ubiquitins, or another enzyme comes to the tip of the tree? The whole thing is a complete dark. But we have just the little bit of the bottom line. Let me take you just to the last part of my talk, and that's medicine. Now, you can imagine that the system of 2,000 components will be aberrated in numerous diseases, and now the field also explodes. There are drugs in the market, and very successful ones. But the principle is the following, and I'll show only one disease. The principle is the following. Proteins are degraded by the ubiquitin system. They are in balance, in steady state. A protein can be excessively degraded, and it will go below the balance, the steady state. Or there can be a mutation in the ubiquitination machinery, for example, and the protein will be accumulated. And what I want to do, to go just to one disease, which is cancer, and to show you what's being done in cancer. So, you can imagine that if a tumor suppressor like p53 will be excessively degraded, you should be exposed to cancer. Or the opposite, if an oncogenic protein or a growth promoting protein like beta-catenin or the growth hormone receptor or the EGF receptor will not be degraded properly and will accumulate, we shall malignantly transform the cell. And people have described diseases on both sides, and I'll show you just one example, or I'll tell you just one example, which is very close to Germany. It's the discovery of Harald Thurhausen, the causative agent of uterine cervical carcinoma, which is the human papillomavirus. And the human papillomavirus causes human cervical carcinoma by encoding an oncogene called E6. Now what E6 is doing, E6 heterodimerizes to P53. That's what it's doing. It generates a heterodimer with P53, and the heterodimer is recognized by the ubiquitin system as an abnormal protein, and the ubiquitin system reads the cell from the heterodimer, mostly from P53. E6 is preserved, is spurred. So the cell is going down in P53, and the virus is happy. This was the purpose of the virus, because P53 is a quality control checkpoint protein. The virus is a small DNA virus that integrates into the cellular DNA, and this integration will lead at the end to its replication and propagation. Now, once the virus will integrate into the DNA by cutting the DNA and integrating it, P53, normal P53, would have been stabilized, come up, and stop the cell cycle, and we try to repair the damage, and if the damage is not repaired, there will be an apoptosis. So first of all, P53 will arrest the cell, cell cycle arrest, attempted DNA repair, and if not, apoptosis. This is the story of P53, again, in very superficial, complete injustice to one of the most exciting and well-studied proteins of the last 20 years. So the virus target P53 for degradation, so it can now, at a later stage, will integrate into the DNA now without the checkpoint protein. So this is a smart mechanism. So this is a mechanism by which, and I'll show you another one, a tumor suppressor is being downregulated. An oncogenic protein takes beta-catenin, that its degradation is aberrated in many colorectal carcinoma. It's a transcription factor that signals for differentiation of the colorectal carcinoma. Once it combines with two other transcription factors, ABS and PCF, it goes to the nucleus. It's the Schevel pathway, the Wnt path signaling pathway in flies. It has been studied in mammalian cells and in flies by numerous people. And beta-catenin is all the time kept down. It's phosphorylated and degraded by the ubiquitin system. Once beta-catenin is mutated in one of its phosphorylation sites, or the scaffold protein of beta-catenin, which is called APC, the adenomatosis polyposis coli is mutated, beta-catenin becomes stable, signals to the nucleus, and the cells are dividing non-stop, and the epithelium via a whole set of events that I'm not going to Vogelstein set of events is transformed. So here you have a decreased degradation of an oncogenic protein or a growth promoting protein versus an accelerated degradation of a tumor suppressor, and you see that in most cases you get it. You get malignant transformation. Now, where to target the system? Obviously, the best way to target the system is rhomboid shape, single E1, 50 E2s, 1000 E3s, 10,000 substrates. When you expect the least side effects, you would like to target the system here, which is the broadest point. You want to take only one E3 to affect a little, small group of substrate, but not to really affect the whole system. So I'll show you two approaches. The system is now amenable to manipulation at any of its levels. There are numerous sites where basically there are every big company is now deep into the ubiquitin system, but I'll show you one past example and one future example, and I end up with that because we are truly running out of time. So the first inhibitor was developed against an unexpected point in the system. That's the proteasome. The machine that degrades proteins, this is the proteasome, exactly the as it was deciphered the structure by Robert Hooker and Wolfgang Baumeister in the Max Planck. The active sites are sitting here, and it was a simple inhibitor of the active site. People knew a lot of proteases how to inhibit them, and here is the inhibitor. It's a boronic acid derivative that electrophilically attacks the threonine residue in the active site of the proteasome. It's a tripeptide. You see one residue of the tripeptide, the second here are the peptide bonds, and it's a drug. It's called Valcate, and we have nothing to do with it. Unfortunately, I would like to have something to do with it, but at that time we just published, we didn't protect anything, and nothing was patented. It was so stupid. But so the drug is made by Johnson & Johnson, and I'll show you one. It's very specific to one group of diseases, which are B-cell leukemias. So these are leukemias of the B-cell. In this case, it's called multiple myeloma. In this case, it's a leukemia. Any physicians in the audience? Some. Very few. It's a B-cell leukemia. It's monoclonal expansion of a B-cell in the bone marrow, in the long bones, and in the vertebra that takes over all the other progenitors of red blood cells, platelets, white blood cells in the bone marrow, and it presses against the bone marrow. The patient suffers infections because it doesn't have white blood cells, and bleeding because it doesn't have platelets, and the B-cells secrete also immunoglobulin. So you can see the rising level, the gulfing level of the immunoglobulin, one species, one molecule of an antibody, in this case it's an IgA, you can see chemotherapy started, so the patient starts to respond, but then the patient relapses, and here started treatment with Valcate. At that time it was called PF341, and you see a nice response, and you can see here another nice response of the bone marrow. Here you see the malignant bone marrow is homogeneous bone marrow with more than 40% of malignant cells, and after treatment, without being a histo-hemato-oncologist and pathologist, you will realize that here the bone marrow is reddish again with all the precursors of the red blood cells and the normal progenitors, and the mass of the red blood of the by FACS analysis, the mass of the malignant cells went down to less than 1%. Here you see another patient. And this patient has a tumor in the lung, in the ileum of the right lung. You see here the chest bone, the spinal, the vertebra, the spinal canal, the shoulder bone, the shoulder muscles, the ribs. This is the lung, the area in the lung. And you see here a tumor, and the tumor recessed following treatment. And this is a non-Hodgkin lymphoma. It's another nice cousin of the B-cell leukemia of multiple myeloma. Why it's particular to these cells? I will not have time to go into it, but these cells are heavy secretors of immunoglobulins, and what happens is that during this secretion, many abnormal proteins, misfolded immunoglobulins, accumulate in the cell. The ubiquitin system typically can take care of them as part of its quality control function, because, you know, every protein that is synthesized, some of it will be misfolded. In this case, you are synthesizing a lot of these proteins, and the system has to cope with a lot of misfolded protein, which it can still do. But once we inhibit the ubiquitin system only partially, then this abnormal misfolded immunoglobulin start to accumulate and they induce apoptosis of the malignant cell. So basically we are inducing apoptosis by eliciting the unfolded protein response. But again, I don't have time for it. Let me just go to the last part of my talk. And this is against P53. And here I'm coming to the future treatment. This is already on the way, but it's a different concept. As I told you, the proteasome is not a specific point, because if I block the proteasome funnels into it all the subsets of the ubiquitin system. So people are looking all the time to more specific points. And the more specific point is the ubiquitin ligase, obviously. So here is one point. As I told you, P53 is a quality checkpoint protein, probably the most important quality checkpoint protein. Every stress in the cell elicits it, will increase its level, nitric oxide, hypoxia, obviously DNA damage. P53 will be stabilized against the ubiquitin system, will induce growth arrest, will attempt DNA repair, and if not, induce apoptosis. So this is a timeline. Now, what happens from time to time, that the ubiquitin ligase, which is called HDM, in the mouse it's MDM, the mouse DM, but in the human it's HDM, is upregulated and we permanently downregulate P53. Typically, there is a, as you all know, P53 is a transcription factor. Normally, P53 will transcribe its executioner. So P53 will go up, it will induce its ubiquitin ligase, the ubiquitin ligase will ubiquitinate P53 and will degrade it, P53 will go down, then it will not transcribe the ligase will go down, then P53 will go up, and they oscillate in a phase difference. But in many cancers, the ligase will go up and will not respond anymore to the transcriptional regulation by P53, and it will turn down P53 down, it will downregulate P53. If you should develop a small molecule that will shut down the ubiquitin ligase activity of MDM2, we shall raise P53 and we shall solve the problem. So one inhibitor, we don't care that it's high because it won't be able to take care of 53. 53 will go up and that's all what we need, and I'll show you one experiment. So this is the drug, it's called Natlin, it's an experimental drug. It sits in the active site of 53 and competes it out. So 53 cannot be degraded because when 53 will come to be ubiquitinated, it will find its site occupied, and that's how it looks like. You add Natlin, 53 goes up. MDM2 also goes up because 53 will induce it, but MDM2 is a dead MDM2 because there is nothing in the medium, so MDM2 will be inhibited. And you can see that this is an active 53 because it will induce P21, and P21 is a cell cycle inhibitor. It will inhibit the cell cycle. And here you can see in control, 45% are in the S phase, in FACS analysis. While following addition of Natlin, only 5% of the cells are cycled. So here you have a specific inhibitor, and once you are trying the inhibitor on skin mice, on a model tumor, you can see that the model tumor grows up. This is the tumor volume. And once you are adding Natlin, the tumor doesn't grow anymore, and if the activity of Natlin, which are the squares, is exactly identical to the activity of doxorubicin, that is a highly toxic DNA chelator chemotherapeutic agent. So you see the same effect. Like specifically targeting ubiquitin ligase, you can take away that, you can really decrease the tumor, and this drug is now in clinical trials. So let me end up here, and I will not go to all this, and just saying the people before just having one comment of conclusion. I did my PhD with Abram, during which we discovered the system. We couldn't do it, obviously, without Ernie Rose, who later shared with us the Nobel Prize, because Abram and I are both physicians, and the modification by ubiquitin, as you can imagine, though I described it simply, it's a very complex modification, and Ernie Rose really is an excellent protein chemist, and he helped us to untangle the chemistry of the... It's a protein that modifies protein that modifies proteins. It's not like phosphorylation, with all due respect to phosphorylation. It's a simple reaction. It's an ester formation between an hydroxyl group that sits on a phosphate to an hydroxyl group that sits on a tyrosine or serine or threonine, and then you can dephosphorylate it. And so it's relatively simple. And this is much complex. And so early in Abraham, and then a whole group of postdocs and graduate students that are still with me. And what I wanted just to say in one word, that I think that I was lucky in a way to participate in an unbelievable journey and to still survive it. And because we started about 30 years ago with a story that we ourselves didn't believe. We didn't know what's behind the corner. So we just were after something that we had some milestones, but we didn't know what's behind. And we ended up with an unbelievable system, not we. The scientific community ended up with an unbelievable system that is not only awfully complex, but also is a huge platform now for drug development, which I think is mostly a lesson for politicians. Because politicians are really pressing to translational research these days. They want to know what you are doing to cure cancer. They don't care about anything else. If we would have been forced to cure cancer 30 years ago, we would have never come to this system, and anti-cancer drugs would have never been discovered. Because in order to develop Valcade, you need first to discover a target. But the target came from a naive, out of curiosity, research. So drugs are not coming from forcing people to look for drugs. They are coming from what I believe is, at the end of the day, just curious science that has no purpose. But we can delve on that much further. So thank you very much for your attention.
Amyloid and wrong cutting will lead to generation of amyloid. Here the ubiquitin system
He's less involved because it's the secretase's function, but nevertheless, in all the Alzheimer's diseases, we are seeing aggregates, and it may be that the precipitation of the mutated or wrongly cut A beta somehow stimulates aggregation of proteins and then clog the proteasome, and the proteasome just is constipated and cannot carry out its function. So the ubiquitin system is okay here, but the defect comes from. But you know, the story I wrote in Neuron Review in a few years, I think that it's outdated, you can read it. But there are a huge amount of literature on the linkage between the ubiquitin system and neurodegeneration. But it's either the chicken or the egg, either the cause or a secondary player. But in all of them, and there is a problem. I just want to show you when the mouse doesn't work. Anyway. Yes, other questions? Meanwhile.
Okay.
Here it is. So you can see, this is the brain sections of Alzheimer patients. In this problem, the problem is a mutated, it's not a mutated ubiquitin, but ubiquitin is the brain, the transcript is coding for ubiquitin with a 19 extra amino acid. It's called UBB plus 1. It was discovered by Fred van Leeuwen in Amsterdam, the NKI in Amsterdam. And you see the sections, and this is immunohistochemistry of ubiquitinated proteins. So you see that the ubiquitinated proteins in order, it is a patient, is flared up, and they really aggregate in the brain because this ubiquitin is an abnormal ubiquitin, and probably there is some problem that the cell sense lack of ubiquitin and inhibition of the proteasome, and here the pathologies start to run down the road. So just to show you a case of Alzheimer's that I didn't have time for.
Do you
guys
show the relation between the ubiquitin system and cancer and diseases? Is there anything known when the ubiquitin system also plays a role in the aging and general process?
Yeah, well, I don't know what's aging anyway. The question was about the role of, you know, people like the idea. Ubiquitin and all these aging people are doing all kinds of things. So they took aged mice and they found that there is a drop in the proteasome activity by 20%. So they measured proteasome activity with age on mice or rats. I don't know what it tells me because I don't know that the proteasome is a rate limiting enzyme in the chain. It starts from E1, E2, E3, and the ubiquitinating enzyme, phosphorylating, oxidizing enzyme. I don't know what's 20%. Less, and if something that accumulates causes a damage or not causes a damage. And for me, my wife happens to be a geriatrician, I don't know what's aging. I don't know that people are dying of aging, they are dying of diseases. What you can say is that in old age, people are more prone to diseases like malignancy. Malignancies are age-related diseases. People are more prone to die from simple infectious diseases, that young people can overcome easily. So basically there is compromise of other systems. I think that the linkage is a little bit, people put it on the populistic side of science, and I'm not sure that they really understand mechanistically what's going on, but the literature is full of it, and I haven't seen any convincing evidence that will link us quantitatively to what's going on. So it's very complex. Yes.
Do you already have any idea with the kind of method from the age of Adrenal, which, I don't know, polyubiquitins?
No, we talk about the chains and
different chains and different.
All what we can do, and even the world master of proteomics, Matthias Mann, is just drowning in an ocean. I just talked to Matthias a month ago. No, because the triptych analysis, you know, we may be able to do some structure. You know, we don't know where it will come from. It may come from structure, but there is no structure in it. The most that we can make structure are for ubiquitin, tetraubiquitin. Once it's becoming longer, we don't even have structure because we cannot crystallize. It becomes hydrophobic and it bends and it. So for we can crystallize and even make synthetically. We don't have even antibodies to all the linkages. But the antibodies are not going to help us either. Because the antibodies are good only when you have an homogeneous chain. Then you can say, okay, the antibody will recognize the 48 but not the 63. But if you have a mixed chain, all the antibodies will jump in. And as a matter of fact, it's so frustrating. There was a work published by Steve Giddy from Harvard, who is the equivalent of Matthias on the East Coast of America. And he took in vitro recombinant system and generated Ubiquitin conjugates with recombinant pure E3s. Let's say it took one E1, E2, E3 and a substrate, and then made the chain on one substrate and analyzed them mass spectrometrically, and he found all the linkages, all the six. But he doesn't know how much. Now by SILAC, he has some idea that there is less 6, more 11, more 48, but he doesn't know how they are scattered along the chain, because there is no chain anymore, because it cryptically digested the chain. So I don't think that people even have in mind or in the horizon future tools that you can say that are behind the corner. They don't have even a concept.
Last question. With regard to the drug which has so much binding to the P53, I'm just wondering that does it affect the normal function of P53, which was whether this binding of the drug forms a dead-end complex, or is it like reversible?
I didn't get the drug against the
P53.
The last one to the E3?
Yep.
You're wondering about specificity?
I'm just wondering that whether the binding of this drug does it alter the normal function of P53. In other words, like if the binding of the drug is forming a dead-end complex or not.
Would, I didn't get the last part of the question.
Is it the binding of the drug is forming a dead-end complex because like it's renders...
This drug, no. But the idea will be obviously to develop stronger one. The problem is that protein, you know, these are drug-to-protein-protein interactions. And you know that it's very difficult to tackle with protein-protein interaction. It's low affinity, and it's occurring on large surfaces. So it will be very difficult to develop small molecules that will interfere. In this case, they somehow were lucky. Therefore, this field that they didn't have time to go of inhibition of the E3s, where the E3 is a protein-protein interaction interface of the system, is going to be not so simple.